Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's talk by Lama Kathy Wesley is entitled Kempo Karta Rinpoche, A Remembrance, Talk 2, Reading Transmission and Carrying a Lineage. Since the time of the historical Buddha, the teachings on how to attain liberation from the sufferings of the world have been kept alive and fresh by generation upon generation of diligent meditators. Lama Kathy explains the three stages of transmissions in Tibetan Buddhism and how lineage helps students to find a direct and unmistaken spiritual path. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbuskTC.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Good morning, and thanks for being here. And I am going to today. I'm going to continue the topic that I started the last time I spoke, which was 2 weeks ago, which was a way of talking about and remembering Kempo Karta Rinpoche, who had been my teacher for 40 years, like 40, 42 years, something like that. And so as he passed away in October, I have, been reflecting a lot on his life, my life, and our practice of the Dharma. And I thought it would be good to talk a little bit about our relationship. So 2 weeks ago, I gave a general overview of my 4 months away. I guess I had a sabbatical without requesting it. Sorry to the board members. You know, I didn't make a formal request for a sabbatical, but I got one. And I think that's pretty good. 23 years, one sabbatical. I think I'm good. So I think I'm ready to go now for the next 23. And then as a result, I gave the brief overview last time about what happened and how I came to go to our monastery at Karma Triana Dharma Chakra in August and do the reading transmission, receive the reading transmission from there. And then I also talked about how I went to Hartford, Connecticut to teach the weekend after the end of the reading transmission, and then how Rinpoche passed away that very weekend while I was still on the East Coast. How I then was directed by Kempo Rinpoche's nephew, who is his chief attendant and also the president of our home monastery at Karma Triana Dharma Chakra, how I was instructed by him to go to the retreat center at Carmeling in Delhi, New York, where Rinpoche had passed away, and be part of the 49 traditional days of prayer that follow a death. Among the followers of the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. So that's a little bit about what I talked about last time. And then I thought it would be good for me to kind of review a little bit the one part of the experience, which was the reading transmission. When I tell people, well, I attended a reading transmission and it took 2 months. They're kind of a little bit surprised by that. They wonder what possible benefit there could be to listening to someone read to you for essentially 7 hours a day, 7 days a week for 2 straight months. And the answer is, yeah, I get your concern and you're wondering. And so I'll try my best to explain what that's all about. And then for the final talk in this series, I'll be talking a little bit about what it means to have a teacher, what it means to have a teacher, and what it means to go on and to go on after a teacher has passed away. I had one of my Facebook friends who has some Buddhist connections. He wrote to me this week and said, now that your teacher is no longer alive, what are you going to do? So I thought that was very kind of him to consider and think about that. And we're going to talk more about that the next time when we're here. But today we're going to talk about reading transmission and lineage in general and what it means. So that's what we're going to do. today. I'm going to start with a short prayer. I frequently start with the prayer of taking refuge when I do talks, because that aims our activity, whatever the activity is, toward the achievement of enlightenment, because that's what it says here. So I'm going to recite it once in Tibetan and once in English. So I'll start with the Tibetan. Anybody who knows it can hum along. That's a joke. People can join in if you are familiar with it. But if you're unfamiliar with it, you can join in your heart and your mind, thinking that you dedicate this session to the benefit and enlightenment of all sentient beings. O Sanje Chudang Soji Chonam La Jang Chu Pardu Dani Kyap Suchi Daji Jin Soji Pei Sunam Ki Drola Pinchir Sanjay Truparsho. And now in English. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Okay, thank you. Last talk, you will remember that I began my talk by explaining how I met Kenpo Kartha Rinpoche, and I want to return to one of the things that happened before I met Rinpoche, and that was, if you remember from the story, when I was a senior in college, I was experiencing a lot of stress. And so what I did was I took a yoga class and started learning yoga meditation, and really enjoyed the meditation a lot, but found that I couldn't find anyone who could teach me more than just the basics of yoga. And I was really hoping I could meet someone who could teach me more than just the basics and give me a sense of what it means to be a meditator and how to meditate on a serious daily basis. So, and what really convinced me that I needed to find a teacher who could teach me meditation was reading the popular American Hindu writer Ram Dass. Ram Dass is kind of a pan-religious figure who followed both Hinduism and the yoga traditions, as well as the Sufi tradition of Islam, and also other wisdom traditions from the ancient and modern world. And he spoke frequently about the importance of finding a teacher and the importance of doing a regular practice of meditation as a way of developing one's own spiritual life. Well, he wrote a book called Grist for the Mill, where he talked about trying to live a spiritual life while we're busy in an everyday world where we have to be so responsible and have families to take care of and jobs and everything else. You know, how can we be a spiritual person? And he talked a little bit about that. And in one of his chapters, he talked about lineage. And in that chapter, he said, I must confess, dear readers, I must confess that I created my own religion. I took a little from this religion and a little from that religion and a little from this religion, and I personally mixed them up together, and that was my religion. He said, but now that I've done that, he said, I really don't feel that's the way to go about it. And so I want all of you, dear readers, to know that my recommendation now is for you to find a genuine lineage that stretches back into history and comes from a fully enlightened and spiritually awakened person. Go find a lineage that traces its heritage all the way back to an original enlightened person, and then pursue that to its conclusion. And then you will have, what he said, a shorter path and a path with less, shall we say, detours. And I was very inspired by that. And it was only a couple of weeks after that I met Kenpo Kartha Rinpoche, who was indeed an exponent or a teacher of a specific lineage that traced its heritage all the way back to the historical Buddha Shakyamuni, who was a genuinely enlightened and spiritually awakened person. So finding Kempo Rinpoche and finding the spiritual path was very important to me. So I want to talk a little bit about why Ram Dass said this. I don't know, because I can't say why he said it, but I'll say what it meant to me. How about that? What it meant to me was that a lot of people I see even now are very interested in spiritual life, but they have obstacles to really practicing spiritual life. Sometimes it's their work life. Sometimes it's their family responsibilities. Sometimes they have a lot to do, and they just don't have time to really devote themselves to spiritual development. And but still, while I'm meeting these people, I find that they all have unique obstacles. And I have found it very interesting that there is one type of unique obstacle, and that is that many people want to be their own teacher. Perhaps they want to be their own teacher because they've been hurt by an authority figure in their past. Maybe they've actually been hurt by a religious figure in the past. And as a result of this, have a deep-seated and possibly logical fear of being victimized by a religion or a person or an authority figure. So because of this very rational fear of being hurt again, they choose to take the place of the teacher. They say, I will be my own teacher, and in that way I will never be hurt and never be taken advantage of ever again. I will never be victimized ever again if I am my own teacher. Now, some people have not really deeply examined this decision to be their own teacher to find out its roots and origins. But after I have questioned many people who come to me with this concern, frequently they voice this after we've had a number of discussions, and they feel that they can trust me with their stories. They may not tell me their entire story, but they may say, I am afraid of being taken advantage of by a church or by a person, and I don't want that to happen. So even though I understand that it's coming from a logical place, there are still some problems with the approach. And the approach that the reason that I have found difficulties with this is because the person guiding themselves is not yet enlightened. And even though they may choose different spiritual paths, and sometimes more than one, and try to do more than one spiritual path simultaneously, it's because they fear not making the right decision. His Eminence Taisi Rinpoche said to me, he said, I think I have, a lot of people have asked me as a Tibetan teacher, he said, what I think the root of the depression that I have seen in many people in the East and the West. He says, many people have asked me, what is the root of the depression that you see among people, the psychological sadness and difficulty? He said, I am beginning to wonder if it isn't an unintended consequence of freedom, of personal freedom, because we have freedom to move anywhere we want now. We didn't used to. And we have freedom to take any kind of work we want to. We didn't used to. We are free to have or not have families. We didn't used to have that freedom. And so on. And he said, because there are so many choices in front of us now, he said, some of us find it easy to make choices, but others among us do not find it easy. And part of the reason we don't find it easy, he said, is because we're afraid of making the wrong choice. And because there are so many choices, and how do you judge which is the best choice for you? You don't, because you don't really have that knowledge on board. What's really interesting is that it's very similar to the conundrum of a person who's trying to look up a word in the dictionary to find out how to spell it. As my husband once said, what's with that? He said, if I knew how to spell it, would I have to look it up? So in a way, it's kind of a conundrum. We both want to be spiritually led, and yet we have our preferences. and we're afraid of making the wrong choice. And so many people are understandably skeptical about religion. As a result, they feel very uncomfortable committing to anything. So because of this, many people will learn exclusively from books, or now that we have the internet, people will try to learn exclusively from the internet. But what they end up with is lots of wrong turns, dead ends, and detours, because they'll follow something for a while and then get bored with it and think, well, it's the fault of the practice, not my fault. Because after all, I'm a smart person, I'm a discriminating person, and so on and so forth. And so this is why I think the Tibetans, when they first came to teach in the United States in the 60s and 70s, they reminded us of how much enormous good fortune it is to meet the Dharma. Because we could have been born anywhere and could have been anybody, but we were born here and now, and we've come in contact with a spiritual practice that can bring us all the way to Buddhahood. So their basic logic behind that is, your karma brought you here. Why don't you stay for a while to see if it's going to work out for you? And when I hear people learning from the internet and relying on the guru of the internet, I worry a little bit, because in the end, who's choosing to visit the websites? An unenlightened person who wants to be enlightened. So we have a little problem. So this is why I encourage people to come to Dharma centers and meet teachers. And whether it's the meditation instructor who teaches your first meditation instruction class, or a lama, or anyone else, just talk to them and find out what it's all about and how you yourself can practice that particular tradition. And once you feel comfortable with, after having asked questions of real human beings — books cannot answer your questions, by the way. I don't know if you've found this out yet or not. A book also will not tell you whether you're meditating properly or not. A book just sits. It may have words of enlightened beings inside of it, but if we're not enlightened and we read the words of enlightened beings, we might get a little confused and get it a little turned around. So this is why asking questions of human beings is good. And so that brings me to the topic of, well, what do those human beings have to offer that is better than or different than a book or the internet? And the answer to that is lineage. And lineage is a funny word, because it sounds a little stuffy, shall we say, a little stuffy. And it might seem that it's a little doctrinaire. We might associate lineage with dogma and rules, and you got to do this and you got to do that, and a little bit more restraint of our personal freedom that we might wish to have. But if we find the right teacher and the teacher recognizes our concern about these things, the teacher will address this, and the teacher will give us their lineage. And how does that happen? How does a teacher give us a lineage? I mean, let's face it, the Buddha lived like 2,500 or 2,600 years ago in India, and he gained enlightenment there 2,600 years ago. So like, how does that lineage stay alive? And how does it come to us? And does it come to us watered down? Does it come to us adulterated with other stuff, and so on? And so we might have these questions. You might have these questions. And so the teachers hopefully will explain to you how they came to practice and what they gained from their practice. And in that way, you might have some confidence that the practice that they're doing is something you could try. But really, the proof of it is in your own mind and heart when you actually sit down and practice. The Buddha entered a very, very deep state of meditation 2,600 years ago to break through decisively the dualism of mistaken thinking and notions. He was able to break through self-clinging egotism and self-fixation. He was able to break through it decisively. And breaking through egotism and selfishness decisively, he was able to experience the fullness of what love is. Enlightened love, enlightened compassion, and enlightened wisdom that arises from that. And so because of the Buddha and because of his teachings, he then gave his teachings to the men and women who were his followers. And each of them carried it to the conclusion that they could reach. Maybe not all of them reached enlightenment in this lifetime, but many did. And then they taught the same techniques and methods. And then some of their students became enlightened. And then they continued to teach. And then some of their students became enlightened. And this is how lineage serves as one candle, to use the metaphor of a candle, the one candle lighting another through history. An enlightened being has contact with an unenlightened being, and then the unenlightened being learns from the master, does the practice, and attains enlightenment themselves, and then they pass it on to the next generation. And even people who are not enlightened beings have the potential to pass on lineage. I know that sounds weird, but even people who are unenlightened can actually give the instructions received purely from the lineage, because the lineage has been kept alive by beings becoming enlightened in every generation. And so as a result of this, they are able to pass on the teachings, and then their students, even their students, can become enlightened, even though the instructor might not be, because of the power of enlightenment itself and how it passes from one generation to the next. Every generation, there are enlightened beings. And so every generation, the lineages stay alive. And when the lineages went to Tibet, the same thing happened. Enlightened beings actually began to appear both in India and Tibet. And those enlightened masters then themselves began to teach what they saw in their visions and what they experienced in their enlightenment. The best example of this is the great Indian master, Tilopa. Tilopa lived 1,000 years ago, and he had, it was said, more than 100 human teachers. But after he practiced and attained enlightenment through his deep meditation, he had a vision of the Buddha. And the Buddha appeared to him. And the Buddha, in the form of a blue figure of awakening, they call it the primordial Buddha, Vajradhara. The Vajradhara appeared to him and gave him, I guess what you could call the shortcut, the quick teachings that became known as Maha Mudra. And then Tilopa, having received these pith instructions, these essential instructions from the Buddha in his vision, he then taught his student, the scholar Naropa, the Indian scholar Naropa. And then Naropa gained enlightenment through those practices. And then through those practices, which were based on the lengthy sutra practices Tilopa had already done, then Naropa taught his student, the Tibetan translator Marpa, and Marpa gained enlightenment. And then Marpa took the teachings, those essential teachings that Tilopa received in the vision. He took those essential teachings to Tibet with him, and he taught his student Milarepa, who then gained enlightenment and taught his student then Gampopa. And then Gampopa taught his student the first Karmapa Dusum Kempa. So you can say that the 17th Karmapa who is living today is a continuation of Dusum Kempa's realization, and therefore is the source of our lineage as we know it today. And this is how all of the lineages of Tibetan practice proceeded, through a lineage of teachers who gained enlightenment through the ages. So this is what I wanted to talk about today, because when a person comes to a Dharma center like this one, they meet lots of people. I can't speak for everyone, because there may be some enlightened beings incognito here. And if so, thank you for coming and being here with us. We need you. But whether how many we have and what kind and where they are, I don't know, but beyond that, what we have to give is the lineage. We have the lineage, and the lineage is given through what is called transmission. And so transmission is the other topic I'd like to discuss. There are so many kinds of transmissions. Anybody who has ever learned anything in their life, whether it's playing a musical instrument, riding a bicycle, skating, parenting, everything that we have learned from somebody else, we've learned through a process of transmission. We sat with a real person. For the most part, I know you can be a parent from YouTube, but I think it's probably better if you actually learn from other people. You can learn how to change a diaper from YouTube, but learning how to be a parent is a little bit more of a person-to-person thing. But I mean, and you can also learn to be a skater by watching YouTube videos, and you can learn how to fix cars from YouTube videos and how to do this or other things from that. But to really, really do it, you have to engage in the discipline and do the thing. And then you will see and how it will work for you. And if that part can be taught to you and guided by a person who's already done it, then there's a little bit of an extra push behind what you learn. It's not just the words. It is a little of the experiences imparted to you, a little bit of that person's accumulated qualities of Dharma is communicated to you along with the words, and also through their sincerity. Human beings, studies are being done about human beings, because why not? We like to study human beings. So the studies that are being done show that a person's emotional state when they are teaching has an impact on what people learn. Surprise. And that people who have a sincere affect and who believe in what they're teaching and have a passion for what they're teaching can often get through to the students in ways that others can't. This is true also in the teaching of the arts. Dance and painting and music and photography, all of these types of arts can be enlivened by the passion of the person who's teaching them. I thought history was really boring until I had an incredibly passionate teacher in my freshman year of college who reenacted the entire Great Crash of 1929 in a single lecture, which included him standing on a desk and shouting. It was amazing. The person won many teaching awards, it turns out, because they were so passionate about history and the meaning of history to us today. So this is why transmission is so important, because it's not just the words, it's not just the gestures, it is the entire affect of the person who has themselves accomplished some, at least a little bit of quality through their practice that helps meditators now. And that's why what people gain here might be different than what they gain elsewhere. There are many styles of transmission. One is the transmission of words, a verbal transmission. So a transmission of the words. Then there's a transmission of what is called the practical instructions, how to practice. There are the words of teaching, and then there are the methods of practice, which we'll call the practical instructions. And then finally, there's another style of transmission that is called empowerment. And empowerment comes from the Tantra tradition, in which an enlightened being appears and gives teachings to a group of disciples, and then that group of disciples teaches their disciples and their disciples and their disciples, and it comes in a fully realized form through the ages. And an empowerment consists of a person who has done a lot of practice, sitting in front of a group and using words to ritually bless and purify the body, speech, and mind of the individual sitting before them. And then also through using symbols, which could be physical symbols like a picture of a Dharma wheel, for example, or a picture of a jewel, which indicates our Buddha nature within us. Through symbology, through using symbols and a ritual, they ritually invest us with the mantra of a particular Buddha or Bodhisattva, and they invest us with the blessing of that Buddha or Bodhisattva so that we ourselves can practice the visualization of ourselves as that Buddha or Bodhisattva. That's what empowerment means. And it's taught, and empowerment is exclusively taught in Tantra. And Tantra, if you remember from earlier talks, is sometimes associated Tantra Yana. The word Yana means path or vehicle. So Tantra Yana and Mantra Yana and Vajrayana all are similar and can be used and are used sometimes interchangeably. And as the first two of the three yanas, the Hinayana and the Mahayana, are based on the sutras, the actual words of the Buddha spoken and written down in through his public discourses, the Vajrayana or Tantrayana or Mantrayana was taught in special places in special ways by the Buddha appearing as this or that Bodhisattva or Buddha and giving specific teachings on how to recognize one's own Buddha nature instantly through the practice of mantra and visualization. The first two yanas, the Hinayana, which is sometimes called the vehicle of individual liberation, and the Mahayana, which is sometimes called the greater vehicle of liberation for all, have to do with specific techniques that deal with such things as ethics and morality and patience and generosity and learning to tame the mind through meditation and to slowly uncover our Buddha nature. Slowly and gradually through good deeds, as it's spoken about in the prayer, and through meditation and taming the mind, as is spoken about. And through doing this gradually and slowly, one uncovers one's Buddha nature. However, the Vajrayana is sometimes called the quick path because the word Vajra means indestructible, and it deals with our indestructible Buddha nature. And the fact that by visualizing ourselves as a Buddha or Bodhisattva, this adds to the previous yanas of discipline and taming the mind and ethics. It adds to that special practices to find our Buddha nature quickly. And this also needs a teacher, because otherwise how will you know what to practice if you don't have a teacher who has your best interest at heart and who also has the knowledge and the skill to train you in the ways of mantra? And so when people start practicing at a lineage center like this, because we're connected to the Karmakaju lineage of Tibetan Buddhism, and that the head of our lineage is the 17th Karmapa, Urgyen Trinley Dorje. And so he is the successor to that enlightened being of the past who received Mahamudra from Gampopa and brought it forward to our present day. So we're a lineage center of his. And so we teach the Hinayana by teaching quiet sitting meditation. We teach the Mahayana by teaching compassion meditation. And we practice the Vajrayana through practicing mantra meditation. And so that's what the Teg Sum in our name means, the three yanas of practice. So when you receive a teaching here, it's actually coming from a lineage and from a line of teachers who have been authorized to teach it over hundreds of years. And so as a result, through this method of transmission, the transmission of the empowerment gives us a purification of our body, speech, and mind, and then we are invested with the body, speech, and mind of the Buddha or Bodhisattva of our practice, such as Chenrezig or Tara or Medicine Buddha, by giving us blessing us with images of the Medicine Buddha or Tara or Chenrezig and investing us with the mantra by reciting the mantra to us and so on. And by doing this, we receive the blessing, not just the words, but actually a little tiny bit of the awakening of that Buddha or Bodhisattva which is transmitted in a moment of meditation, when the master sits and meditates on the nature of their mind, and we just sit quietly fairly close to them. We sit fairly close to them, and then we meditate also. Maybe we don't get enlightenment on the spot because they're meditating, and maybe we don't enter a deep state of meditation because they're in a deep state of meditation. But there is some impact, and that impact is a feeling of confidence for many people. And that, in that way, it's not that enlightenment is transmitted to you. It's that confidence arises in your stream of being through the transmission. You have confidence that the teaching will bear fruit for you as it has borne fruit for the teacher who's giving the transmission. And empowerment is only one of the types of transmission. There's also the practical instructions where they teach you how to recite mantras, how to visualize, and how to do a specific practice. And finally, there's the, and that's actually, there are Tibetan names for all of these. The empowerment is called wang, which can be spelled W-O-N-G. And then the practical instructions are called tri, T-R-I. And then the verbal instructions are called lung, L-U-N-G. Lung is, the meaning of it literally is breath. And so just as the breath of someone is necessary to make the words, we're also receiving the blessings of the author of the text or of the person who is transmitting it. And so this was what was behind, this idea of transmission is what I feel is behind what we are doing here at the Columbus KTC. And we did a little bit of mathematics one time and figured that we have taught more than 5,000 people how to meditate in the 40 years we've been around. If we have from 1 to 5 new people a week, that we've taught, you know, literally thousands of people how to meditate in that period of time. And so each of them received a lineage, and they may not have been able to follow that lineage or pursue that path, but they received the blessing of that lineage through the transmission of the practical instructions for how to meditate. And so this is why great masters often arrange to give or bestow a whole cycle of teachings and a whole cycle of empowerments and a whole cycle of transmissions. And these have mainly been done in Asia up to now. These lengthy transmissions that take 1 month or 2 months or 3 months or more have mostly been done in Asia. And because that's where the majority of the great masters live. But it was Kempo Carter Rinpoche, the founder of our center, it was Kempo Carter Rinpoche's idea that that a transmission, of a long transmission event that conveys a lot of blessing should be given at the monastery, Karma Triana Dharma Chakra in Woodstock, New York, this summer. And that was why Lama Karma called me in July and said, are you planning to go to the 2-month transmission of the entire collected works of Karma Chagme? And I said, I hadn't planned on it because 2 months was a long time to be away. And he said, well, Kempo Rinpoche wants you to be there. And it wasn't until I got there, because I finally decided to go ahead and do it because the teacher was asking me. And he's never steered me wrong yet. In the 40 years I've known him, he's never steered me wrong. So there had to be some important reason for me to be there. And when I got there, on the second day there, actually on the first day there, I met the most remarkable person, and that was the Dorje Lopan, or Vajra Master, Lama Tobden, who had flown all the way from Tibet to give a reading transmission of the 60 volumes of the works of the 17th century saint Karma Chagme. And so I said, okay, and we all sat down and we did some prayers, and then he opened the books and started to read. And he wrote at what he read at what I would call an auctioneer's pace. And it went very quickly, and you could make out specific words from time to time, but really it was just a torrent of words flowing over you. And I said to myself, I'm not sure how this works, but after the second or third day, I began to realize, oh, wait a minute. He had us do Om Mani Padme Hum mantras while we were listening. And at first I was thinking, well, that's surely going to get in the way of us hearing anything. But if you recite Om Mani Padme Hum very softly and his voice was amplified over the loudspeaker, you can definitely hear it. There was no problem. And in fact, what it did was it took away extraneous distraction by being attentive to the mantra. Other extraneous distractions began to fall away, and after a while, it was just you, the mantra you were reciting, and that voice in your head of the Vajra Master reciting words of blessing over and over and over again. The 60 volumes contained dozens of empowerments. We didn't receive the empowerments with implements and symbols, but we received them in a way through the lung, or the reading transmission of the words. And so dozens of empowerments, dozens. And then also dozens of practical instructions, dozens. Even if we couldn't make them out, we received them all. And the experience was really unique, because after a while, at first you're thinking, this is kind of weird. This is kind of boring. How am I going to keep going through essentially 2 months of this? How can I do this for 7 hours a day? Well, how could he do it for 7 hours a day? He's reading. He was drinking herbal tea for his throat every single day. Cup after cup after cup of herbal tea with Tibetan medicine dissolved into it. And he never lost his voice. Never. And he received this transmission himself. He said, in Tibet, in a vacant, abandoned building in the middle of nowhere, and they all slept on the ground with a thin cover over themselves. And they ate root vegetables that they actually buried in the ground so they wouldn't be eaten by scavenging animals. And they just stayed and stayed and stayed for 2 straight months, day and night, listening. And so that transmission was successfully given to that small group of monastics several years ago in Tibet. And then one of the people who attended that gave it to us. And so you could say that the transmission from the 17th century saint, who was transmitting not just his words, but his realization through the words, was received by us. Now, I didn't arise from my seat enlightened. So that didn't happen for me. But what I do feel, and I did feel, was a growing confidence. A growing confidence in my ability to be an exponent of the teachings, even if I was not an enlightened being. That I could do it honestly, with integrity, ethics, and everything else. And it was also clear to me that the reading transmission itself carried some power, because just sitting and listening to that voice, I was able to meditate in ways I had not meditated before. Just listening to that voice saying things to me. I didn't even know their meaning, but I just rested with those words and the sound of those words and just let them come in. And I felt like I received something, and that it was valuable and good for me. And then I heard an explanation of the benefits of receiving it, because we asked one of the lamas who was there to read Karma Chagme's own list of benefits from receiving the reading transmission. And one of them was, if you are feeling tired in your mind or in your body, it will help to refresh you. And if your life force is getting used up, it will actually refill it again. And so now, and then once I heard all of this, all of these benefits, I realized this was why Rinpoche insisted that we all show up. because he knew, and those of you who heard the story that I told a couple of weeks ago, he knew that his life was almost over. And he wanted to provide something for us that was intangible and would last forever. And so, and he wanted any of us who were having depletion, he wanted to fill us up again. And so this is why he insisted on all of us being there. And there were many people who made it for the entire thing. I was guessing somewhere between 10 and 20 people were able to be there for every single minute of every single day. And I was happy to be able to tell Rinpoche at the end I was there for the whole thing, because he really wanted to know. And he passed away 1 week to the day after it finished. It finished on a Sunday, the 29th of September. He passed away the next Sunday, the 6th of October. So he wanted to receive it because he himself never had. In his 95 years on this earth, he never received it, but he always wanted it. And now he was able to accomplish his heart's desire and hopefully give us a transmission that would carry us into our future. So I wanted to explain a little bit about what transmission is and why we do it and how it gives us something that's intangible but powerful and profound that allows us to practice our Dharma with a little more confidence, so that we will not have to go chasing the guru of the internet, and we will not have to go chasing the guru of books. Because as you know, what was that old saying about a lawyer? A person who is their own lawyer has a fool for a client. Yeah. People who try to be their own teachers have a fool for a teacher, especially if they're not enlightened yet. And so what we have to do is we have to find confidence in something and the ability to invest ourselves in something. And lineage is a good thing to invest ourselves in. We should not invest ourselves in a lineage before we have examined it and before we have tried to practice it, because hopefully the practice itself will give us something. Kempo Rinpoche said to me once, he said, when I first started teaching in America, he said, I was aware that many of the people I taught in America did not have a particular religion to which they subscribed. And he said, and I also know that many of the people that I was teaching were people who really had not developed faith in anything. And so he said, I wasn't expecting that they were going to develop faith and confidence in Buddhism, because they didn't have a history of it. He said, and this is why I taught everyone to meditate and to do quiet sitting meditation. Because he said, usually because of their past karmic connection with the Buddha's teachings and with meditation, he said, when they sat down, even the first time, even if it was not the easiest meditation ever, they would feel something. And they would recognize that difference in their minds from sitting down and practicing just a little bit. And he said, and that would give them faith and confidence that they could actually practice the lineage of teachings and get something for themselves from that. He said, they gained faith through their own experience. And so it is that Kempo Rinpoche has since then, when he's taught, has used both the lineage of transmission, but also the individual receiving the lineage, receiving the transmission, using their experience, their own practice and experience of what has been transmitted, as the proof, as the confidence of the rightness of the teachings. He was brilliant, absolutely brilliant person. He let us figure it out. And in fact, a few years ago, someone from our congregation, when we were still over on Grub Street, asked Rinpoche, well, what supposedly happens in the pointing out instruction of Mahamudra when a teacher points out the nature of a student's mind after they've done all of their preparation and their nundro and their preliminaries? What happens? And Rinpoche said, ideally, he said, they would achieve the first level of bodhisattva awakening on the spot. And the questioner said, well, you and I both know that's probably not what's happening for the majority of people. And Rinpoche answered, well, you're right. It is really rare. And he said, well, so what's happening for most people? And he said, they have an experience in their mind, and that experience gives them confidence. And that confidence is what leads them to awakening. So interestingly enough, Rinpoche felt that the students, and he said, but people overemphasize, Rinpoche went on to say, people overemphasize the pointing out instruction, thinking that it's magical. He said, so this is why I prefer to teach students the step-by-step Mahamudra approach, so that they unveil their own Buddha nature for themselves, by themselves, with a teacher's guidance. So that's really interesting. The teacher's guidance is essential to teach you the proper way to practice, but then you find it for yourself. And he said, and they have more confidence because they have found it for themselves. It wasn't that somebody told them something. So I wanted to at least say a few words about this, because once again, to explain what I feel is the absolute genius of Kempo Kartha Rinpoche and how he taught us. He taught us from a place of transmission and lineage, taught us the practices, and then really urged us, and in fact sometimes held our feet to the fire, so to speak, by reminding us of how important it is to practice. And by doing that, we uncovered our own confidence and our own abilities. And by doing that, we felt convinced of them and then became capable of teaching the next generation. It's brilliant. In any case, that's what I wanted to talk about today. And I apologize, I took you all the way down to the end. I made you listen for a long time without questions. We can do maybe one or two questions. So if anybody has questions, the microphone is open for you. And we can answer if you have questions. If not, that's okay too. But if you got one, we got time for one or two. Okay, there's one. Got another one? Mm-hmm. There's two. Okay, we have our two questions.
Thank you, Lama Kathy.
Thank you.
Not really a question, just a little plug I like to include when we talk about something like this.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, if you get online and talk to Buddhists around the country, Westerners who are trying to make it, so many people, you know, who are their teachers? And it will be some famous author or something like that. And really, there's no contact. It's the book, it's the YouTube videos and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And just mentioning, for those who don't take advantage of it, what we have here and with our own Lama and with our lineage is so special. And set up an interview with Lama Kathy. Get guidance on your own practice. And it's something that is rare. And most people don't have, and I just like to encourage people to take advantage of it.
Thank you, Marcus. I don't know what to say except that could work. But there are other people here who teach meditation as well, and we also have a mentorship team. Marcus is part of that team. Eric Weinberg, who's also a member of the team, is here. And you can also find the mentors, because I acknowledge, and I am the first to acknowledge, I am not to everybody's taste. And so that's why we have other people who can assist as well. And I just encourage you to ask meditation instructors questions and build your own confidence in asking questions, so that you can get the most out of your practice. Additionally, I also have met lots of people who say that authors and YouTube video authors, and book authors and YouTube video authors are their teachers. And I actually think that's it's not all bad, because for people who live in remote areas who don't have Dharma centers in their communities, sometimes that's the only way to connect, but that they could and should make aspirations to meet teachers and maybe even meet the authors of their videos, or the teachers who have been authorized by those masters to teach. And if you can, that you try to make an effort to go to one of the programs. I think Mingyur Rinpoche is a good example of this. His center is in Minneapolis. So we can make aspirations to someday go and attend one of his teachings. Or the masters who teach at KTD Monastery and so forth, to make aspirations to go with us. Because we still have road trips to KTD, and it's we'll call it a 12-hour highway bonding experience. But anyway, okay, thank you for that. Yes.
My question is, what does your teaching say, or in relation to your teaching, say about the other teachings of the Buddha that are not typically included in the teachings of this lineage? The example that I think of is the Eightfold Path.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not talked about in this lineage, but it's certainly a very prominent teaching of the Buddha's.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you bringing this up, because I think that the Eightfold Noble Path is actually taught in this lineage. It's just that different teachers emphasize it in different ways. If you look at Kempo Kartha Rinpoche's teachings on the Eightfold Noble Path, he gave teachings on it in his book Dharma Paths, because the Eightfold Noble Path is the essence of the fourth of the four noble truths. The first three being suffering being part of life. The second, that suffering has a cause, which is clinging and fixation. The third, which is that letting go of clinging and fixation is the cause of enlightenment. And number four is that the Eightfold Noble Path is the method for attaining enlightenment. But what has happened is that the Eightfold Noble Path is practiced in a different way in our tradition than it is practiced in other traditions. And so learning the Eightfold Noble Path of right action, right thought, right motivation, and all of the rest, is they're not taught in a way like, first we are going to practice the first of the path. Next week we will practice the second of the Eightfold Noble Path. Next we will practice the third of the Eightfold Noble Path, and so on. The Eightfold Noble Path is actually contained in the 10 virtuous and 10 non-virtuous actions. And we teach those extensively. And in addition, the four statements made by the Buddha that summarize the Eightfold Noble Path, do no harm, practice virtue, and tame your mind, this is the teaching of the Buddha, are often taught in this tradition as an abbreviated form of the Eightfold Noble Path. And so it is taught, but not in the same manner that it is taught in other traditions. It's not that it's ignored, or it's not that it is pushed to the side. It's actually folded in. It's actually folded into all of the teachings. When you learn the 10 virtuous actions and the 10 non-virtuous actions, you are understanding the first two of the most important parts of those four statements, do no harm and practice virtue. And then taming of the mind is the third. And then the fourth statement is, this is the teaching of the Buddha, means look no further, they're all here. So the Buddha even summarized the Eightfold Noble Path himself so that for people who wanted to practice it in that formulation, they could. The Tibetan tradition also teaches what are called the four foundations of mindfulness very differently than other Buddhist traditions, but they still teach them. We call them the four thoughts that turn the mind toward Dharma, rather than teaching them in the form that you see them in other traditions. But they're still there. Yeah. So it's not that something is left out. Yeah. Kempo Rinpoche said one time, he said, it's not that we left stuff out. It's all in there. It's just in different formulations. So I think we should I take one more question? I think I should take one more question. Is there one more out there? If there is, I just want to be sure. Yeah, there is one. Okay, go ahead.
I just want to say that you can listen to Alan Watts on YouTube. And I even after I stopped listening to him for like a year, and then I listened to him again, it's still like relevant.
Yeah. You know, Alan Watts was among the first Buddhist authors that I read in college. I read Alan Watts' Zen books. I can't say that I understood them, to be honest. I think my mind wasn't ready to really understand them when I was in college. But I bet you that if I read them today, I would find different meanings in them than I found in those days. And I think that's because our spiritual path is progressive. Everyone. Oh, by the way, the modern Christian author Bo Lozoff, who was a prison minister, a Christian prison minister, he once said very, very rightly. He said, "We're all on a spiritual path. We just don't know it yet." And the minute that we recognize that we are on a spiritual path, and then kind of get with it, he said, then we're going to be much better off than when we don't realize that we're on a spiritual path. But he said that. He said that when we come to spirituality, we're in a different place when we start. And then as we progress, we continue to be in a different place all the time. And I found that to be true in my own life, that when I started practicing Dharma, I had one set of understandings. And then later, I had another set of understandings and so on. And so you can hear the same. This is why I think that the teachers repeat themselves so much. When I was first practicing in this tradition with this center, Kempo Karthar Rinpoche often would emphasize the same things over and over and over again. And some people would get quite impatient with that. They'd say, why doesn't he move on to other stuff? And that's because do no harm, practice virtue, and tame your mind, which is the summary of the Eightfold Noble Path, was all he was really wanting us to know. So he just repeated them in different ways and different times and different places so that we would get that we actually had something that we could practice and that we should kind of get about it, you know, start working on it. And so now I am so appreciative of that approach. Because even though I can't rattle off all of the teachings he gave, I still know, do no harm, practice virtue, tame your mind. I still know that one. And because of that, I can talk about the third and fourth noble truths in a way that at least somewhat cogent. So anyway, well, because of time, we have to stop here. But it's just been incredible, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about all these things. And when I talk to you the next time, I'm going to talk to you about, it'll be like the third part of the presentation on remembering Kempo Rinpoche and the main things he gave us. And it's going to be about the teacher-student relationship. And the title of the talk is, I Am Always With You. And so hopefully you can listen in by podcast if you can't be here. And if you can be here. And we'll talk about those things. Now let's sit quietly for a moment. There is a dedication prayer on the back of your paper here. We'll read it once in English and then sit quietly and mentally dedicate the merit of our session today to the to the confidence of beings in their spiritual path and the following of their spiritual path and their enlightenment and then subsequent benefit for beings. We'll start with the words, by this merit. By this merit may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy, wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may we free all beings. The courageous Manjushri, who knows everything as it is, Samantabhadra, who also knows in the same way, and all the bodhisattvas, that I may follow in their path, I completely dedicate all this virtue. So now we'll sit quietly for a moment and mentally dedicate the goodness of our session. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.